Why Maine is such a great place for birding, and why it matters. This year has been named the Year of the Bird in honor of the 100th anniversary of the passage of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. Conservationists worldwide are hoping to focus on protecting bird populations for the next 100 years. And among them, the scientists and educators here at the Skudik Institute at Acadia National Park. This weekend, they are holding a Year of the Bird celebration, in addition to all of the other bird watching and ecology projects throughout Acadia throughout the year. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will learn about the migratory species that are starting to stream through our state and about a new citizen science effort to count them. Live from the Skudik Institute, Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Skudik Institute at Acadia National Park, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. 100 years ago, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act was enacted. So what is that? What is the Migratory Bird Treaty, and why does it matter? Well, I have three guests with me today to talk about the importance of that landmark measure, as well as its future and all things birding in Maine. Dr. Adrian Leppold is Project Director of the Maine Bird Atlas 2018 to 2022, which is produced by the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. Dr. Jeff Wells, the author of the Birders Conservation Handbook, as well as other books, also a fellow of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. He is currently Senior Scientist for the Boreal Songbird Initiative. And Seth Benz is Bird Ecology Program Director here at the Skudik Institute and is responsible for coordinating biodiversity research, conducting citizen science, is it phenology, is that right?
Correct.
And migration monitoring efforts, as well as developing bird ecotourism programs. So, as always, we want to hear from you. Are you a birder? Have you ever been up here to the Skudik Peninsula to take part in one of CESS programs? Have you been involved in other citizen science efforts? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling. I say that every day, but it's different today. Or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Jeff Wells, what makes Maine such a great place for birding?
Maine's sort of at a confluence where we have northern birds that come down here to breed and southern birds that come into the southern part of the state. And then we have a flood of literally millions of migrants that come down through from the Arctic and Canada on their way south. So we just have this tremendous abundance and diversity of birds, and of course all of our different habitats, from the puffins and terns and gulls along the coast to seeing Bicknell's thrushes at the top of mountains, and sort of everything in between, all the different kinds of forest and wetlands and lakes. Just an immensity of different kinds of birds that make Maine special.
And Seth, what about right here? Why is the Skudik Peninsula such a great place for birding?
Well, it offers birding all year round, and oftentimes the winter can be the best. Our auto loop is easy access to the water, nearshore waters. And of course, in between the auto loop, we have extensive conifer forests and some old farmland that's been since transformed, and it makes for a variety of habitat and a good deal of bird variety that comes here.
You say a good deal of bird variety. How many kinds of birds have been spotted here on the Skudik Peninsula?
Well, in Acadia National Park, I believe the official list is something like 353.
Wow.
And according to eBird records, that is, citizen scientists that come here or people who come and bird and use the app eBird, the number is more like 285.
Hmm. Adrian, I understand it's the beginning of migration season. You are a migration expert. Are we just a little bit in, or is migration already pretty much in full force?
Well, we're just a little bit in for the most part. Waterfowl are moving. We're getting early movements of blackbirds and some of the migratory woodpeckers that come through. But really the bulk of you know, the birds that are going to fill our forests come May and June are still just barely leaving their Central American or South American wintering grounds and heading across the Gulf and hitting the Gulf coast of Texas and Louisiana and such. And so we can expect real spring migration to kind of ramp up by the beginning of May.
You know, we're supposed to have some snow this afternoon into the evening. Does that affect migration?
So it doesn't affect the amount of weather and storms that we're expecting. This is pretty typical for this time of year, and most of the birds that come back this early to somewhat more unpredictable weather conditions are adapted to dealing with that. Individuals that may be getting closer may hold off a day or two from coming up. And then we also have some species like robins and woodcocks that can even, if the weather persists for longer periods of time and they have enough energy reserves, they'll move back south and then come back north.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
They'll take a little detour and hang out.
We're like, nope, too early. This isn't good. We're heading back. And so that's why people see robins move in and out of their yards at different times of the year. Sometimes they're there even in December. In winter, if the conditions are suitable enough for them, they can stay up here.
All right. Well, we're doing this program today. You're having the program this weekend, Seth, because it is the Year of the Bird, and it is the Year of the Bird because it's the 100th anniversary of the Migratory Bird Act. Jeff Wells, how did the Migratory Bird Act come to be?
Well, at the late in the late 1800s and turn of the century, there was unregulated commercial harvesting of birds. People used even things like cannon guns, they were called, so they could shoot 50 and 100 birds at a time, and they would harvest them and send them to market. So you could go to their, you know, your local Hannafords or Shaws of the day and go into the market and buy, you know, a dozen robins for 25 cents or a couple of bufflehead or black ducks for a dollar, things like that. And then going a little bit further into the early 1900s, people started also taking birds to decorate hats. And so there was just sort of wanton slaughter of so many birds. We saw the disappearance and eventual extinction of passenger pigeons, thought to be the most abundant bird on Earth at one time, probably 3 billion of them, and we've them to zero by 1912. And Eskimo curlews, actually the last one ever seen in Maine was shot on Schoodick Lake here in the 1920s. But all of that was happening at that time. And so a lot of groups started forming, Audubon societies, and started trying to enact legislation. Eventually, to make a long story short, they sort of found that they needed to have some kind of new way of thinking about how to protect birds that was really remarkable at the time. Based on science, they knew that birds nested in one place and went somewhere else to winter. In other words, they crossed state lines and national boundaries, and they needed to have some kind of treaty and then eventually legislation that would protect them in all those places, a holistic view, rather than doing it state by state, because they had been trying that and it wasn't working. And so a whole group of people worked over many years and actually into World War I, when, you know, the world was in was havoc, sort of, and yet they were able to pull this together and eventually get this treaty signed. That's one of the most groundbreaking treaties, and then eventually legislation in Canada, the U.S. and Mexico to protect birds, and still admired around the world as one of the most important wildlife protection treaties and legislations ever enacted in the world.
Sure. So pretty much everybody alive today won't remember a world when people hunted the kinds of birds that we just like to look at today. Seth Benz, what is the Schoodick Institute? What is Acadia doing to celebrate the Year of the Bird?
Well, the Institute fashions itself as promoting ecosystem studies, and we do that through field research and engaging the public in that field research. So we're highly dependent upon getting people engaged. We call them citizen scientists to come here and participate in the science, authentic work that's really helping our understanding of all kinds of biodiversity, in this case, birds in particular. And this weekend, we've invited Jeff here for an evening presentation tonight at 7 o'clock here at the Moore Auditorium. He'll be talking about a book that he and his wife wrote called The ABCs of Birding. It happens to be about Aruba, Bonaire, and Curacao, and we're excited about that presentation. And then tomorrow morning, for folks that want to come out and enjoy a little bird walk or a bird excursion with Jeff and myself, we will lead a little group around Scudic Point to see what we can see.
Adrian, I understand you are also involved in a big citizen science project just launching this year. Tell me about it. Tell me about the Maine Bird Atlas and what listeners can do if they want to be involved.
Yes, perfect. Thank you. So as you mentioned at the outset of the show, the Maine Bird Atlas is a five-year effort that the department has sponsored and is directing and running, and it's an effort to document the abundance and distribution of all breeding and wintering birds across the entire state of Maine. So not a small goal. And to meet that goal, we're really, like many other atlases that have come before us, are looking towards citizen scientists, individuals out there that either actively bird already or even just pay attention to the birds in their own backyard, to get involved and contribute their observations for this project so that we can amass data enough to give us a comprehensive understanding of bird distribution around the state of Maine.
Is this an online project? You go in and fill out a form or just send somebody an email? How does it work?
So for the most part, we're encouraging people to get involved by going online, but we definitely don't want to exclude individuals that don't have regular access or don't feel comfortable with that. So for example, a lot of our regional, local bird experts have folks in the Amish communities that are really active birders and want to participate, but they're obviously not going to go online and do all of that component. So people can just keep track of their observations. Ultimately, we'd encourage them to enter them online through our website, the project website, but they can also just keep track on paper and send in, mail in their observations as the season progresses.
What do you hope to learn from the Maine Bird Atlas that you don't know already?
So that's a really good question. So in 1978, Maine actually conducted its first breeding bird atlas, and that ran from 78 to 83. And bird atlases are a pretty standard way now of getting a comprehensive survey of distribution, and 21st century atlasing has added an abundance component. So we're getting population estimates as well. And the international recommendation for conducting these surveys is actually 20 years. And so 83 was when the last one ended. So Maine's a little behind the ball, a little behind the curve. So, you know, we're 35 years into it, and so a lot can change in 35 years. So understanding how species range distributions have shifted gives us an idea of habitat quality or land use. Birds are great indicators of the environment and of environmental change. And so where we might see changes in their occurrence, that can be indicative of other changes in the environment or land use that would be of interest for us for managing species into the future.
All right, Jeff, we were talking before about the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, which is 100 years old. What does the future look like for that? Are there any challenges to it?
Well, there are actually. The current administration is sort of reinterpreting the law in a way that no other legislation, government has done in the past 100 years to sort of allow for more take or which in the policy parlance means, you know, killing of birds or their nests without any real oversight of what happens. So the law has been extremely important in allowing government agencies to ensure that the least harm is done to birds in whatever activities people undertake on the landscape, and to try to mitigate those. But that's seemingly going to be erased under the current administration. And there's a lot of bird groups and other groups working to try to convince them that that's a bad idea after 100 years of one of the most historic bird conservation treaties and laws out there.
So when you say reinterpretation, not looking to undo the treaty act altogether, but to say we're going to interpret this portion of it differently. We're going to, when a project, some sort of industrial project or energy project comes online, we're going to interpret how the act applies to it in a way that's different than before.
Yeah, basically to say that they wouldn't really have to even consider their impact on the birds. They will kill birds, but they wouldn't have to make any amends for that or try to change what they do to deal with that. So very serious issue. And like I say, you know, 100 years of other past governments of all parties have not done it that way. And this is alarming, of course. You know, again, when you say that this is one of the most historic kinds of bills and treaties we've ever had in human history, to see it sort of undermined is not a happy thing for people who care about birds.
All right, Seth, I heard from a little bird that a big report came out just about a week ago from Audubon looking at predictive models for birds in this area. What did you learn from that we didn't know before? Actually, tell me about the project before you tell me what we've learned.
So the study actually took a long-going effort, the Breeding Bird Atlas, which is different than the Bird Atlas that Adrian has been speaking about. But the Breeding Bird Atlas is a series of car routes, and people go a distance, and then they get out of their car and listen for birds, and then drive the next increment and listen again. And so we're taking, I believe, the data from 1965 forward is the most accurate data, and we're combining that with Christmas bird counts, which is, again, another large citizen science effort that's been going on since 1900. Taking the data from both of those studies and combining them to look at bird populations. But then the interesting part of this study is to combine that information, the bird information, with climate change modeling. So we know that, for instance, Gulf of Maine waters are changing, their temperature is rising, or the ambient atmospheric temperature is changing. Many of these kinds of changes are being incorporated into that model. It means that habitats themselves are changing. The forests of Acadia National Park are actually under great change. We don't necessarily see that on a day-to-day basis, but we know that red pines are in trouble in the park. Spruces, now this point, Scudic Point, is a predominantly spruce inhabited habitat, along with some balsam fir and things. And the predictive models that are talking about rising temperatures over time are telling us that the spruce forest that we see here is going to be replaced with perhaps an oak maple forest in the future. So it'll look more like a Pennsylvania Appalachian mountain forest than it does currently. And so what that means for birds that are here now is that they're going to be extirpated or move, change their ranges. But I guess the good news is that other birds coming from the south would replace some of our birds. Perhaps the most significant thing that stuck in my mind was that if we see accelerated change in climate, our black-capped chickadee, the state bird of Maine, it's very possible by the year 2100 that we no longer have black-capped chickadees in this part of in the state of Maine, that they will have moved on and possibly be replaced by another chickadee coming from the south called the Carolina chickadee.
Well, guess what? We have to take a quick break already. When we come back, your comments and questions. We're talking about birds in Maine. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do the Lunder Foundation, in support of the Colby College Museum of Art, always free and open to the public, and the University of Maine's Framing Maine series, presenting an evening of song and story with David Mallett, April 7th. Tickets at framingmaine.com.
Prize-winning oceanographer Jim McCarthy says his career began when he first saw pond water under a microscope as a kid.
I knew there were fish in those ponds, and I knew there were bugs, but I had no idea what was living there in the microscopic realm. And just being really fascinated.
Famous scientists, just kids at heart. I'm Steve Curwood, and that's next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
Join us for Living on Earth, Sunday morning at 7 on Maine Public Radio.
J.K. Rowling wrote the final chapters of the Harry Potter series in a swanky hotel. She found it was the only place she could focus. Many artists and thinkers use this strategy.
They go somewhere physically isolated and different where they can, without distraction, think deeply.
Most of us can't retreat to a five-star hotel, but we can do something else, quieting the distractions, this week on Hidden Brain.
Hidden Brain is Sunday morning at 11 o'clock on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we are broadcasting from the Skudik Institute at Acadia National Park. We're talking about birding in Maine. My guests are Dr. Adrienne Leppold. She is Project Director of the Maine Bird Atlas 2018 to 2022, which is produced by the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. Dr. Jeff Wells is author of the Birders Conservation Handbook and a fellow of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Seth Benz, Bird Ecology Program Director at the Skudik Institute here at Acadia National Park, is also with us. We invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. And the audience here is also welcome to ask a question. Before I go to audience questions, though, Adrienne, how many birds have you banded in your lifetime?
We're into the six figures.
Wow.
It's been a lot, combining seabirds, waterfowl, songbirds, and raptors. I've crammed a lot in a 16, 17 year career thus far.
If people want to be involved, if they want to learn to be a part of a bird banding project, you'll help train them, won't you?
Absolutely. Well, and you know, with what I can fit in with the Atlas project, that's been kind of all consuming right now. But that's a good opportunity to also mention that there's an entire bird banding association. There are three of them across the country. And we, of course, being in Maine, are part of the Eastern Bird Banding Association. And I'll be hosting their annual meeting here at the end of June. So that's also a great opportunity for any budding researchers or scientists or students to come out and hear some great presentations, connect with other professionals and individual banders from all over the Eastern Seaboard into the Mid-Atlantic.
And we'd love for this, for Skudik Point, Skudik Institute, to become one of those training places for the banding to happen. We have had a couple of sessions in the past few years with Adrienne leading them, and they've been quite successful.
And bird banding's so important, obviously, because you're able to track populations, but also where birds end up. And sometimes there's some big surprises, aren't there?
There certainly are. And, you know, historically, that's how the concept of bird banding started, was to put an individual marker on a bird and see if it could be found elsewhere or even be recaptured again at a subsequent later time, seasons, whatever. And honestly, when it comes to songbirds, which is what I have, you know, the most experience with, the real purpose of banding at this point is to get the data that you can acquire at the time of capture. So we get a lot of information about the demographics of population and age and sex ratios, and measurements about individuals, especially on migration, give us an idea of what kind of condition they're in. And then over time, you can look at and utilize banding data to track trends. And it's been interesting because, you know, a lot of long-term banding station population trends are showing the same kind of patterns that we see from the breeding bird survey data that Seth was referencing earlier. And so, you know, especially when all of that information is telling a similar story, it provides more strength to what is actually happening out there and how we're interpreting it.
I'll start with an email from Robin. During a recent show on wildlife, we did a Maine Calling show recently on wildlife in your home, when you don't want it there. During the recent show on wildlife, one of the guests mentioned that if you have bird feeders, you will attract mice, squirrels, and rats that could also get into your house. I'm wondering if today's guests have any advice about setting up a feeder system with pest prevention in mind. Jeff, I know that you have some bird feeders. What do you do?
Well, the pest prevention part, I'm not so sure I am the best person to answer. Keeping your areas clean of spilled seed is one of the probably the best things you can do. If storing your seed in a very a container that animals can't get into is probably maybe the second most important thing. As far as preventing things from climbing up into your bush or your tree and getting out a feeder, it's very difficult. There are some ways to do it, but if you place them on poles away from trees and you put some sort of a covering so that something can't get up the pole, you can prevent most animals from getting up there. But those are the main things that I've employed or seen employed.
Go ahead, Adrian.
I just wanted to add, in the context of Jeff mentioning, keeping the area on the ground clean, that it's really important for people who feed birds, and I do myself, to keep the feeders clean as well. And I think this was mentioned on the wildlife show, but I even recently have gotten some reports from our avian rehabbers in the state, and they're actually seeing a big increase in the finch conjunctivitis that's happening. And so there are diseases among birds that aren't of danger to people, but that can be communicable between individual species and in between species. And feeders are often sort of a breeding ground for some of these bacteria that cause these birds problems and can lead to death. So
bring your feeders in, empty out last year's bird seed. What do you wash them with?
I would say even empty out last month's bird seed. I think it's a 10 to 1, or 9 to 1 ratio of water to bleach. So a little splash of bleach and a bunch of water. Make sure you rinse the feeders really well. I would say at least every season, every change of the season, it would be good to bring in your feeders and do a good thorough cleaning.
All right. I thought we had a question here in the audience. Go ahead. What's your name?
I'm John Archer. I'm from Schoodick Point area. I'm asking a question about the climate change. And recently, in the last week or two, this group out of Boston, Frontier Group, a nonprofit, works on energy. And they've talking about offshore wind. And they came out with this quite a dramatic study that said that all of the Atlantic coast electric needs plus transportation plus heat could be supplied by offshore wind. Now this is way offshore wind, and this would, they claim there would be double that amount of electricity produced by offshore. So we could then approach a quarter of the climate carbon problem in the United States with this offshore wind. And I'm wondering how birders feel about something that could actually go and attack the problem of climate change, even though there may be problems with some bird loss.
Jeff, you've worked on this, haven't you?
I have, yeah. There's a lot of different opinions in among birders. Sometimes it's very controversial because wind turbines do kill birds. But of course, so does coal mining. In fact, much of the coal mining that's generated our electricity in the past completely strips all of the habitat away, so there's not even a place that they can breed in the future. They just strip the tops of mountains off and plow them into the adjoining valleys. Other forms of energy have a lot of problems, as we've heard, as we get into more fracking and drilling and even, hydropower that, we here in Maine, we are spending tens of millions of dollars to try to restore some of the runs of fish to these rivers, and yet up in Quebec they're putting big dams on rivers that are still pristine and still have things like Atlantic salmon that are endangered now, so we can import them down here. So all forms of energy have major impacts, and we really should be thinking carefully about that. In the case of wind turbines, that there will be impacts, but at the same time, you know, we don't have the climate change pollution that comes from them. And, you know, most work that I've done and seen shows that the overall impact to bird populations is probably less than from things like from electricity generated from coal. But it is very kind of controversial, especially when people might have a chance of seeing a turbine in their own field of view, and they're used to getting their electricity from coal mines in down in, you know, West Virginia and even South America, or getting hydro from way off in Quebec where they don't see it. So my own feeling is it's sometimes better to have the energy produced closer to home, because you are going to pay attention to trying to make it as the least harmful as possible if it is something that is closer to home.
All right. We'll go to Colin, who's calling from Graham Lake. Hi, Colin. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you for taking my call. I'm the education outreach manager for the Down East Lakes Land Trust, and I'm on the planning committee for the Down East Spring Birding Festival, which is in its 15th year. I just wanted to highlight one of the many opportunities for birders around the state, both at beginner's levels and right up to experts. We have the festival coming up on Memorial Day weekend, May 25th to 28th, and numerous walks led by local guides. And many opportunities. So if you visit DowneySpringBirdFest.com or .org, sorry, you'll be able to find all the information there. But it's one of the many festivals around the state.
All right. Well, thanks for calling, Colin, and good luck. And Seth, go ahead.
Yes, and thank you, Colin. I'd like to add to that the Acadia Birding Festival is also happening at the end of the month from May 31st through June the 3rd with post field trips on the 4th and 5th of June, and that's attended by about 300-350 people, and it's quite popular. Takes advantage of all of the habitats of Acadia National Park, and this year will burgeon out. They go I think it's to Caribou Speckled Mountain to look for Bicknell's thrush, which is a higher altitude thrush that has a specific habitat where it likes to breed, and that's the best place to find those. And we're also going to Waldo County this year and doing a Waldo County hotspots field trip for the day.
So, all right, and I'd invite you, Seth, and or somebody here at Skudik, as well as Colin, who called, and anybody else who knows of a terrific birding opportunity, to post it on our Maine Calling Facebook page. Jeff, go ahead.
I was just going to add that, you know, one of the best things, if you're a listener and you're not really into birds yet, but you want to be, is to go out with other people. And, you know, there's so many opportunities now, you know, with local Audubon chapters, these birding festivals, and there's also birding festivals in the Blue Hill area and in Freeport coming up, and there's probably others. There's one up in Aroostook County, I know, and there's others. You know, Maine Audubon has trips. Land trusts, most land trusts now have birding trips, and just getting out on those, you know, state parks, national parks, national forests, you name it. There's so many opportunities. I do a couple of trips for the L.L. Bean Outdoor Discovery School and for Natural Resources Council of Maine. So there's just, you know, if you look around, there's lots of opportunities, and you should, if you want to get into it, that's the best way to do it. You learn so fast when you go out with other people.
And a way to hang out with some pretty nice people, too, usually, right?
That's right.
We have an email from John. Last year's loon count on Alamoosuc Lake in Orland came up with no baby loons. Is there any way to project this year's birth rate in Maine? Adrian?
That is a really good question. It's variable, but over time, the trend since the loon count started, I don't actually even know the start date. I mean, it's been at least 10 or 15, maybe pushing 20 years now. Overall, the loon population in Maine has been a good, strong increase. So the loon population is definitely doing well. It'll be interesting to see, because it's a balance with predators. And as we've increased our eagle population, bald eagles have been frequently observed preying on even adult loons, but certainly their chicks become easy prey. But, you know, nature keeps that balance in check within itself. And so I don't think there's any reason to have concern. It could just be that, you know, maybe there was a predator that came into that area on that particular lake, or if it was an inexperienced adult pair that took over territory, maybe they were less, successful at producing chicks that year. But, you know, there are a lot of individual factors that could answer that question. But I think overall, no reason to be concerned about loons.
In the predictive modeling that we spoke about earlier with respect to Acadia National Park, actually the common loon is a bird that is of concern because the increasing visitation of Acadia National Park is putting increased pressure on our water bodies and our wetlands, and that may put pressure on adult breeding loons, which could impact their reproductive rates and so forth. So it is a bird that this particular study cites as one that we should be very concerned about, and perhaps begin a mitigation process of looking at how we treat our waterways, our lakes, especially within the national park.
We do have to take another quick break. We're talking about birding in Maine, and we are live at the Skudik Institute of Acadia National Park. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Finance Authority of Maine, working for Maine by helping businesses grow jobs and families reach their higher education goals. FameMaine.com. And Norris, helping businesses and schools stay safe through engineered security, life safety, and emergency communications systems. NorrisInc.com.
Dairy farmers in Vermont are facing tough times, but just 15 miles north in Quebec, it's a different scene.
Drive around on the countryside. Look at the farms. The tin is painted. The tractors are put away. There are nice farms in the States. I'm not saying they're all run down, but there's a lot more farms that are run down in the States than in Canada.
Both sides of the milk economy. On Next from the New England News Collaborative.
Next is coming up in about 20 minutes at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. An invasive insect that could kill all of Maine's ash trees and tear up the roots of tribal culture is right at our state's door. Maine is working hard to keep the emerald ash borer at bay, but entomologists say it's only a matter of time before the battle is lost. Maine Public has a special in-depth online report where you can learn more about what's at stake for Maine, including the state's four Wabanaki tribes. Visit mainpublic.org and click on the homepage link, The Scourge at Maine's Door, or search for Emerald Ash.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We are broadcasting today from the Skudik Institute at Acadia National Park, and our subject is birding in Maine. My guests are Dr. Jeff Wells, the author of the Birders Conservation Handbook, other books, and he is also a fellow of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Dr. Adrian Leppold is project director of the Maine Bird Atlas 2018 to 2022. She's the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. And Seth Benz is Bird Ecology Program Director here at the Skudik Institute. Join our conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Adrian, before the break, we were talking about loons. You wanted to add something.
Well, I just wanted to follow up with what Seth had said, which I'm really glad he mentioned the importance of, you know, looking ahead to the future and predictive modeling and showing, you know, what could be of a concern as time goes on. And really, you know, these loon counts, which is actually another citizen science project run through Audubon, you know, there's no immediate concern. We're seeing an increase in the populations, but over time things can change, and definitely at the local scale. So that, I can't remember what lake in particular our question came in about, but another thing that can and has been affecting loons and their health and productivity is lead poisoning from fishing tackle. So that may be something of interest at a local scale too, for people to think about and consider.
We have a question here in the audience. What's your name?
Lucy Shapiro. I'm from West Goolsboro here on the Skudik Peninsula. We see gulls all year round, and they're beautiful and fun to watch. However, going to Bar Harbor the other day in the rain, a spring rainy day, there were hundreds, maybe even thousands, but hundreds of gulls on so many of the meadows and the golf courses going from here in onto the island. What are they doing? I never see such abundance. And are they eating worms? Are they eating fresh, tiny grass?
Good question.
Yeah, I think our worms, you know, when it's really rainy, the worms come up out of the ground and they love them. Yeah, so they cover the fields. And
thank you.
Yeah, so we have an email from Wendy Wren, and her last name is W-R-E-N, and we have a note from our producer, really. So Wendy, thanks for writing in. She writes, I am a beginning birder. This morning I walked around Mackworth Island at sunrise and was excited to see my first wood duck of the season among the eiders and buffleheads I've seen through the winter. Then when driving off the causeway, I was thrilled to see my first great blue herons of the season, hoping the birds bring the spring weather with them. And then she had a follow-up message. Upon inspection of the photo, I believe the wood duck was instead a red-breasted merganser. I did mention I was a beginning birder, right? It can be hard. I was talking about this with Jeff earlier that, you know when you see a bald eagle, but that's pretty clear. And there's certain a robin, but there are certain birds that are really hard to tell the difference.
Absolutely.
Tips?
I would encourage Miss Wren to come out on or to get out with Maine Audubon or a bird club, local bird club, to go out and, you know, what they say, practice makes perfect, and you can get better by doing it over and over again, as the three of us have done all through our careers.
Well, and it's not uncommon that, you know, even as a quote-unquote expert, you know, I feel like every spring I'm relearning some of, especially identifying by sound. You know, I'm relearning the songs because it's been 8 months since you hear a certain species, and there's, you know, 20, 30 different warbler species that come back in May, and it's really overwhelming. I would just encourage people to get out there. And that's the nice thing about the Atlas is you don't have to be an expert. Even if you just tell us about the chickadees or the robin that nest in your yard, we want and need to know about it. And the Atlas itself, through the website, is we framed it so that we can put people in touch with other experts or mentors to go out and connect for helping people learn more, too.
We'll go to Peter, who's calling from Cherryfield. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to share a little family birding miracle that we cherish in our family. My mother was a lifelong, really professional bird watcher. She knew them all and all the songs or whatever. But in her late years, in their 80s, as dementia set in, she forgot the names and the sounds of every single one of the birds. And it was very tragic for us to watch that. But she came to live with us in Cherryfield, where we have, guess what, bald eagles. We're sitting out in the yard. A bald eagle came in low. And mother snaps out of her dementia and goes, oh, my gosh, Peter, look, it's a bald eagle. We are so lucky. We are so lucky to see a bald eagle because they were almost extinct. Now, mother was never political, but during the time of Rachel Carson, she wrote letters. She went to rallies to try to save the bald eagle. And at the end of her life, the bald eagle came over and blessed her, blessed our family.
What a terrific story.
It's a wonderful story.
Thank you for calling and sharing that. We'll move on to Tony, who's calling from Bucksport. Hi, Tony. Go ahead.
Hi. I had a question about the Migratory Bird Act. There seems to be this weird thing about bird nests, and you're not allowed to pick them up or hold them. But if they're in your tree after the season, you can cut the tree down or burn the field or whatever. And it just seems like a lot of kids and people like to pick up old bird nests. And if the birds don't reuse them, why is that law there?
Good question. I love
bird
nests.
Do you want to tackle it, Jeff, or should I?
Well, I mean, strictly by the letter of the law, it's there to try to prevent people from harming birds' nests. You know, when they're at risk. It is technically illegal to do that, but it's a question, I think for the most part, in the enforcement, people recognize, the enforcers, that some of these things are not serious. You know, I'm not speaking as somebody who's working in enforcement, but just from my observations, you know, I think for the most part they've been very common sense in applying that. It's just like any law out there, and you have to use common sense in enforcing and applying it. And it's maybe technically illegal to do that, or to pick up a feather, or anything like that. It's and there's reasons for it, to try to prevent people from, you know, wantonly destroying nests, eggs, and birds. But you know, in recognition, you know, of kids picking up a nest or picking up a feather, that happens all the time, and you don't see you know, game wardens running around arresting all of the kids with, you know, holding up a gull feather who picked it up on the beach. So, you know, it's common sense. Adrian might have some more from working with an agency about it.
Well, I mean, it is a really good and legitimate question, because most people don't, as you mentioned, part of the act is also, in addition to nests, the whole bird or parts of the bird, including the feathers. So most people don't even realize that the cardinal or blue jay or chickadee that they see year round in their yard, individuals of those species do actually migrate. So you're technically by law not even allowed to pick up that blue jay and have that blue jay feather in your possession. And I'm guessing, you know, trying to think back to what the people 100 years ago that were writing this act may have been thinking of. I think the intent was, you know, there was a lot more pressure and concern at that time. And so, you know, if somebody had a feather or a nest, there was going to be no way to show that their acquisition of that wasn't, you know, resulting in harm to the bird. Where this day and age, it's unlikely. And as Jeff said, there's limited enforcement. There's some level of common sense. But technically, if you want to possess even a carcass, if a bird hits your window and you find it dead in your yard, you're technically not allowed to have that without a state scientific collection permit. But, you know, it's within reason, I guess.
And it is good to remember that, you know, at the time when this passed, there was this massive trade in bird feathers, you know, and people were trying to use different tactics to get around it by saying, oh, I got these somewhere else. They, you know, this came from, you know, so they were all kinds of tricks they were using to go out, and they, you know, they were going out into like heron rookeries and killing every bird in it, you know, and shooting cannon guns at flocks of waterfowl and killing 100 at a time, you know, and taking thousands and thousands of passenger pigeons, you know. So this is what they're dealing with. You know, egg collecting was very big. You know, some of you may have seen in old museums all these nests or eggs that was happening, and people were selling those. So people were trying to find, you know, the last ivory-billed woodpecker nest, or the last ivory-billed woodpecker on existence, or the last California condor egg, and taking that and selling it. That's what they were dealing with at the time.
All right. Well, Tony, thanks for your question. We just have about a minute left. I'm going to take a tweet from Michael. As someone new to birding, I found apps like @SongSleuth that David Sibley helped develop useful. What's your take on using tech for improving birding skills versus traditional guides?
Well, there is another app called Merlin that's put out by Cornell. I use that quite extensively with folks that I work with, and it's been perfected over the years. So basically, it asks you some basic questions. What color are you seeing? Is the bird on the ground, in a tree, in a shrub? Just by answering some fairly easy observational questions, it gets you to the identification of the bird. And Merlin is trying to move that identification along to then submit your sighting to eBird so that it actually becomes birding with a purpose. You're contributing to science.
All right, so 10 seconds, a tweet from Jim. I'm going to give this to Jeff because I know you would like to answer this question. How do we encourage nesting birds without making an easy meal for our cat?
Well, the best thing you can do is keep your cat indoors. You know, we have two cats, and I'm a cat lover, but they've stayed indoors their entire lives because it's almost impossible to keep an outdoor cat from taking birds. Unfortunately, in my yard, I have my neighbors who keep coming, and I'm trying to get him to keep him there indoors, but that's the best thing you can do.
And that's our final word. You just heard from Jeff Wells, the author of the Birders Conservation Handbook, a fellow of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And Adrian Leppold is also here, project director of the Maine Bird Atlas 2018 to 2022, which is produced by the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. And Seth Benz, a bird ecology program director here at the Skudik Institute at Acadia National Park. We want to thank everybody here for helping us. A special thank you to Sarah Brundage. Roddy Nickpour ran the board. John Bradford helped us here at Skudik. He's our engineer. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.